I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Curzon Film Podcast. This week we'll be discussing the incredible 120 beats per minute, and later we'll be joined by the film's writer and director, Robin Campillo. Joining me this week are Irena Musumeci.
Hello.
Hello. And making his podcast debut is Julian Allen. Hello.
Hello.
You are a first generation film Twitter person.
Oh dear.
An Orson Welles connoisseur, a cricket player and a choir singer.
None of which qualify me for this podcast.
All of them damning.
Thanks a lot.
Julian, you've written about Robin Campillo before for Reverse Shot. Mm-hmm. Is that correct? Do you want to quickly just talk about Campillo's work before 120 Beats Per Minute? Just how does this film reflect on his sort of development as a filmmaker?
Sure, yeah. Well, just factually speaking, I mean, Robin Campillo was a film student in the early 80s in the famous French film school, La Fémis. He came to prominence actually as an editor for Laurent Canté, who's perhaps a more established filmmaker. And his collaboration with Canté was so sort of happy and fruitful that he became very quickly his co-writer on some of his best films, notably Time Out and Heading South and The Class. He himself broke into directing with a film about, well, ostensibly about zombies, but of course it was about much more than that, called They Came Back. That made a few waves, but I don't think got released in the UK. His subsequent film, Eastern Boys, which is the one that I've written about, was essentially a bit of a liberation from his earlier work, in the sense that he started to find, I think, his voice as a director. One of the key things about that is that he allowed actors effectively to decide and inhabit the sequences that he was directing, and he bounced much more off the actors. And I think 120 BPM, beats per minute, is probably a culmination of that process. And as soon as he found with Eastern Boys that he could do this, he decided it was time to make this film, and here it is. It's fantastic.
Without further ado, then, let's quickly introduce the film. So 120 beats per minute, or should we agree on what to call it? Because I've seen it called many different things in different places.
I think we're just going for BPM.
Go for BPM?
Yeah, it's shorter. Generally. Yeah. It's okay. Shorter, easier.
So BPM follows the AIDS activist group ACT UP in Paris in the early 90s. And while we begin to focus on the group as a whole, we focus in on the very outspoken Sean, played by Nahuel Perez Biscaya. Have I pronounced that name okay?
You should ask our French expert.
Well, I'm not Argentine, and he is, yeah. So I don't know.
Okay, we'll say yes for now.
Yeah.
And then the shy newcomer, Nathan, played by Arnaud Valois, and the relationship that develops between them. So here we go. Robin Campillo, as Julian just said there, known for his work on The Class, Heading South, and They Came Back, and Eastern Boys, who was an active member of ACT UP Paris in the 90s. And I was lucky enough to speak to him a few days ago. So enjoy.
Okay, so Robin Campillo, welcome to the Curzon Podcast.
Hello.
So we're here to talk about 120 beats per minute. So I wanted to start by asking you about the fact that you were a member of ACT UP, mm-hmm. and how your experiences with the group have translated into this film.
You know, it's in a very, very simple way, because, you know, I didn't do this film out of documents or this kind of thing. I did this film out of my memories. Okay. And the funny thing is, I think when I was in the group, unconsciously, I was a recording machine, you know. Okay. So it's unbelievable how many details, how many impressions, feelings, moments of sensuality I had in mind for many years, during 25 years.
Yeah.
And as it was like I was just waiting to write them down on the script, you know. So it's really, it's like everything in the film is connected to my experience in the film, but it's in a fictional way, in the way that I try to make a structure which is not exactly reality,
right,
and to kind of create a perspective, not to understand the meaning of all that, because that would, I don't believe that cinema is about meanings or this kind of thing, but just create a perspective just to show how it worked at the time.
Okay. So I read in an interview with you recently that Philadelphia, the Jonathan Demme film, was quite important to you at the time because it was these big Hollywood actors talking about AIDS to a mainstream audience. And I wanted to ask you then, in general, do you think AIDS as a subject is something that films have tackled well, or is there, are there ways they can do that better? And then what did you want to do with this film that those films didn't talk about?
I really think that there are no good subject or bad subject. When I'm talking about Philadelphia, it's not exactly that I love the film as a director. It's because I thought I was thankful that someone was doing something that, you know, it's something that a gay director say a few years ago in the celluloid closet, that he was thankful when there was a kind of gay in a film, even if it was a caricature.
Okay.
Because that was good anyway, you know? And I had this feeling at the time. But, you know, it's always, and that's why for many, many years, I didn't try too much to make a film because I didn't know what to do.
Okay.
You know, the AIDS epidemic is not a cinematographical object by itself. You have to know what the heart of this thing is important to you, and you can put it in your film as an electric central, you know what I mean, to create emotions, movements, and all of those things. So it took me years and years, and I know that, of course, you know, there has been about ACT UP, for instance, documentaries,
a lot,
but I wanted really to make a fiction because, for me, in the 80s, as I thought that we were, as gays, we were like poor gay guys, victim of the epidemic, and like we were like, and when we were an actor, we were actors of this epidemic.
Okay.
So it was a fiction process too, you know?
It
was a way to reinvent ourselves in front of this epidemic. So it has something to do with fiction and not documentary, you know? So that's why it was important. But if you see in my film, you can see documentary images, but I wanted to show them to make the fiction even more imaginative in a way, you know, to make the people realize that it was really a fiction.
Yeah.
And so, you know, you don't, it depends on the director, if your cinematic approach is interesting, there's something, but you know, you have to find a way.
And was there a sense when you were writing BPM or conjuring up what you're going to make that you wanted this to be like the film that you would have wanted to see in 1992 when you were part of ACT UP, that you thought as a young gay man in Paris that this would have been a film that would have really spoken to you then? Is there ever a sense of that for you?
That was impossible
to
imagine this film 25 years ago. And that's the thing, because it was impossible to imagine the society right now 25 years ago.
Yeah.
And it's very weird because we have to admit that things changed.
Mm.
Not all the things. And you have another topics, another problems. But it changed a lot, I think. And I think that Act of Paris in France helped a lot to change the perception of all that. I mean, the HIV epidemic, but also the gay community, lesbian community, the trans, all those things have been changed because of Act of Paris, I think. And but I couldn't imagine this thing. And you know, it's not, it took me so much time to be able to do this film, and I think it's because I was trying to work on my cinema to know what how to be to find a very fluid way of directing people and scenes and editing all that. I was trying to have a kind of flow you know, and so after that I knew that I could do this film. I realized that with my previous film, Eastern Boys, that I was able to do it, that I was ready to do it, because of course I didn't want to make a failure of this film, you know, because it was too important to me, that the two important things in my life, cinema and the AIDS epidemic.
Right.
So I won't do 10 films like this one, you know. And that's why it took me some, but I would have been, I think, whatever the quality of the film, I would have been amazed in 92 if I could have seen a film like this one. I really think that was unbelievable.
Yeah. And you mentioned how a lot of the film is fiction. I'm interested in where the characters come from, because they're all, I think all the characters in the film serve many different roles. Like they are, they're friends, they have almost, you know, closer than brothers and sisters, and but they're also each other's doctors, they're also each other's advisors, and they also have to act like politicians and writers. I mean, how do you conjure up these characters that have to be so many different things?
It's, you know, for instance, I was a little bit inspired by real characters, but not so much, because I was really inspired by the contradictions between people, the electricity between people, and even the tensions between people. And I was really inspired by that. So you have a few characters like the young hemophiliac and his mother. They are really like in reality, and they saw the real person, saw the film last year. It was amazing because, of course, that's fortunately he survived the disease. And he was very young. It was like 14 or 15 years old when they were there. So that was good. But, you know, so I put that on the script. But after, there's a long process which is called casting. And for me, that's the characters are decided at this moment, because I choose actor and my actors become the characters. I forget what was in the script, you know. And if you want to have three-dimensional characters, it's better to look at your actors instead of looking at your script. And the more you forget script, the more you are, you take the richness of everyone, and so you have to find the right persons, and that means also, because you understand your film more and more when you are working with that, when you are choosing the actors. For instance, you have Sean in my film.
Yeah.
And I was searching, I didn't know why, for a foreign actor.
Okay.
He's not French, he's from Argentina. And for someone who is overplaying a little bit, you know, a little bit, a baroque actor, I would say. And I found this guy, and because I wanted Sean to be someone who is at the same time sincere, but who has a kind of theatrical distance with his disease. And I wanted that because it's someone, you know, when the disease becomes more and more strong, this distance is not possible anymore. And when it end up in the hospital, I told my actor, you stop to play. It's over. You don't do the same thing. You are not the same character. Because most of the time in film, we ask the actor to be very homogenic.
And it's stupid because we are not the same in different situations. And it was hard for him to stop playing, but I don't think that's very important. And on the contrary, because I think Sean is someone who is burning himself in the struggle, and I wanted someone who was overprotecting himself, and that Nathan and Arnaud Valois is someone who is protecting himself because he was an actor, but he was very hurt because he didn't get the part he wanted, so he stopped. Okay. Being an actor, and he became a master, and I took him back to cinema, and I knew that he was very quiet, and he liked to touch people as if he had healing hands. All these details are very important, but it was not exactly like this in the script. You know, it was a little bit in the script, but because I was confronted by these guys, they became more and more interesting when I'm talking about Arnaud Valois.
Yeah.
I didn't invent all these backgrounds. This is his background.
Okay.
So that makes something which is very rich, and I can talk about all the actors this.
I think there would perhaps be a sort of existing conception about that a film about AIDS might be a bit depressing and a bit downbeat, but BPM is so energetic and so full of life. Can you talk about what sort of techniques you use to get that energy into the film and that sense of like vitality?
Of course, because for instance, I remembered some anecdotes, you know, like some slogans which were so stupid and funny. And you know, it's also, you have to think, the first time I got into the meeting, it was so funny. There was such a jubilation. But It was because it was 10 years after the beginning of the epidemic, and we were so tired to be on our closets, and you know, and the epidemic, the disease took us back to closets. That's the reality. That there was this kind of energy, and we were like just like badasses, you know. I don't know how to say, I say like outcast fags and dykes, you know. We were so excited about all that, and so, and we were making jokes of ourselves, and that was so funny. I realized that I even asked myself at the first meeting, but where is the disease? You know, because it didn't show, but of course it showed after, but shortly, Matt, unfortunately. But I really wanted to talk about that, and I wanted to show that it's like in a film, the guy who did Life is Beautiful, it's a wonderful, like Frank Capra.
Yeah.
You know, what we call Scottish shower, you don't have this expression in English.
Okay.
It means when you come from cold water to hot water directly, you know. It's because of the material, red and blue, Scottish one. Yeah. And so it means that you can come from one emotion to the opposite emotions. Yeah. And so the film is funny because you have this kind of movement, like you are on a roller coaster and you don't know.
Yeah.
And in the middle of a very sad or very tense debate, someone is saying something so stupid that someone is laughing, and the opposite happened, like the moment where they are talking about these stupid slogans for the gay pride, and the guy say, it's maybe my last gay pride.
Right.
And I'm still moved by this slogan so much. It's like how could we make fun of this? And of course, we knew that the spectators, the society around us was terrified by this kind of slogan. So it was kind of fun for us, but it meant something real for us.
Yeah, absolutely. Great. Well, Robin Campillo, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thanks. So before we begin, you saw the film quite a while ago now, didn't you, Irena?
I did, and then I rewatched it on Monday very recently, a couple of days ago, when we had an introduction by Robin Campillo, who was over for Flair, the BFI LGBT plus festival.
Okay.
So I've had a refresh, which was much needed because I bawled through the final 40 minutes of this film the first time I watched it, and all the way home, which makes it a total of about 120 minutes.
Wow, perfect.
Yes, I saw it at the London Film Festival last year. Okay. Robin Campello also turned up for that. It's notable, actually, that if you trawl YouTube to find Robin Campello talking about BPM, you will find dozens and dozens of pieces of film. He absolutely loves talking about his film. It's a film that's dearer to his heart, and he really wanted this message to come out, and he is tireless in promoting it, and rightly so. Mm.
Yeah, I mean, it's fascinating because it's obviously such a personal project, and sometimes when filmmakers write and work from the heart in such a way, the product is at times questionable, perhaps not very objective. And I think actually what is remarkable about BPM is really this absolutely amazing representation of the history of activism that ACT UP have kind of been responsible for in France, but it's also a film that goes way beyond that. So there's this kind of three-part structure to me, mm-hmm. The sort of the activism and looking at how these groups work together. Then there's this love story and concentrating on this couple that forms out of the actions that the group takes. And then there's this absolutely arresting final section, which is about, I called it death in my summary of the film, but it's also so much more than just death, and it's sort of a sense of life and death together. I mean, obviously, every story of AIDS is a story of death and the story of facing up to very probable death. And I think the film has not just this personal quality, but really quite a universal, appealing, emotional quality that is very connectable and very relatable.
Yes, I agree. I mean, if you think about the structure you were describing there, talking about the group ethic, the sequences of debate in the auditorium, and then you have this very, very personal, narrow-focused love story, which ends, we won't spoil too much, but it sort of ends in a very emotional way. And then you have the coda, which is the group reunifying around this, and there's a kind of marriage of the two different themes, tones, aesthetics, all together, and that's a rather sublime sort of way to finish the film.
It's really something that I was very struck about in Eastern Boys as well, this real ability that Campillo has to kind of work with large groups and yet be able to kind of individualize each character quite sensitively and quite concisely and very economically. You don't have to know a lot of backstory about many characters to understand where they've come from and why they're doing what they're doing, which I think is brilliant. In a Hollywood film, the opening scene, the opening 20 minutes of this film just would have a long explainer about who is who and why are they doing what they do and how do they come to be part of this activist group. And yet here we just start straight into the action. And the opening action, which is literally an action that the activist group are taking to disrupt what I think is a sort of medical lecture or a lecture of a pharmaceutical company discussing their latest findings, which obviously the activist groups deem to be totally insufficient and not open enough with the actual patients and the victims and the people who absolutely need the drugs that these people are working on. And the action goes wrong. And intercut with the action, which is sort of where you're placed as a viewer from the very beginning. You're right in the middle of it, up to a point where you're so close to it that you don't know what you're looking at, is a sequence that takes place in a meeting of the activist group where the discussion is all about what went wrong and why. But we are introduced to that by a character who is Thibault, I think, is one of the leaders of the group, who is explaining the rules of engagement to the four new people who are joining. And these four new people, among them are two characters who are going to be key. One of them is Nathan, and the other is Jeremy. And the rules of engagement are 100% accurate from my very sort of limited knowledge of ACT UP. And I found these fascinating.
I'm really glad you picked up on that, actually, Irene, because one of the things about Campillo's writing is that he doesn't expose or explain at all. And he was very conscious, I think, coming into this film that he simply couldn't get away with that. But happily, because he's a brilliant writer, he found organic ways in which to do so. You've given a prime example of that, which is that new people who came, from what we can gather, came to these conferences and meetings every week or so. A group of new people would come in, and they would be welcomed in and have it explained to them. And of course, the other brilliant sort of technique he uses is to use the discussions and debates themselves and people's essentially account of what occurred, people's accounts and people's arguments against what should have happened, what didn't happen, what went wrong. Those things are all very expository. They all essentially bring you right into the action, and they explain precisely where you are and what you are. So you're dragged right into it organically, and yet you're given an awful lot of explanation quite early on.
Yeah, there's quite a lot to focus on. But what really struck me about the rules of engagement in the activist groups were a couple of things. One was this notion of we don't applaud each other, regardless of what the intervention is and whether people approve of it. We click our fingers and kind of. And so because that's such a bizarre thing. Yeah. And so I was really glad to have that explained to me. And it's never been 100% clear to me why the clicking on the fingers as opposed to the clapping.
I remember, like at uni, like poetry slams and things like that would have no clapping. It would be that. I'm not sure.
There's definitely a time element to it because they were saying. I mean, these meetings were clearly quite late at night, and everybody was tired and frankly ill, and they needed to get home. And actually, the more clapping there is, you can add half an hour to the meeting, can't you? So I think there was that just basic prosaic practical element.
There's also what I kind of then. Sort of made it my interpretation was to think that, you know, clapping is a very loud and very disruptive
And too
oral
like overjoyed and like for entertainment purposes, I guess.
Whereas the clicking of the fingers is snappier, is shorter, and it's quieter, and there's kind of a lot of emotion in the room, and at the same time the clicking kind of sends a sign of approval but not a sign of celebration, which I thought was really interesting.
It's also a wonderful cinematic technique.
Absolutely, exactly. I was going to say that it just sounds incredible. Yeah. And at the screening I was at on Monday, at the end, the screening room erupted in an applause, and then people started clicking their fingers, which was brilliant. And the other thing that is very, very striking about the rules is this constant aspiration to democracy and to the idea that everyone has a right to speak in public, but there are rules of engagement. You need to put your name down if you want to speak. First, you raise your hand, you put your name down on a list, and when it's your turn to speak, you speak. And that is the rule. That rule is broken a number of times because obviously emotions intervene and people want to explain what they did and why they did it. And there's a lot of sort of power balances and imbalances in the room. From my experience of certain activist groups, that was very recognizable, how, you know, everybody kind of starts with this role and everyone starts with the same objective and the same mission. And yet things kind of fall apart inevitably. And I thought there was a real sense of understanding of the dynamics of the group, which was not simply to say we're all fighting for the same thing and it's going to be wonderful and it will all have a great major impact. Of course, the work of activist groups like ACT UP was fundamental in taking us to the place where we are at today in terms of AIDS awareness and medication for HIV, essentially. It was really, it's impossible to understate just how vital that work was. And it had results. But inevitably, all of the groups that were participant in the big kind of fight of the 80s and 90s to, you know, raise awareness of AIDS and kind of fight against AIDS, they all fell apart.
It's interesting you picked up on the power dynamics, because one of the more captivating things about the ensemble sequences for the debates is that you have characters in the film who are clearly primary characters. I mean, it's obvious fairly early on who is going to come out of this as a primary character. And you have people who have stronger characters than others. You have some very shy and retiring people in these scenes, quite deliberately so. And Robin Campello himself made no secret of the fact that he was one of the shy and retiring ones in these meetings. In fact, I think he admitted to slightly fantasizing that Nathan, played by Arnaud Valois, was a sort of version of him. The way Robin Campello puts it is a very hunky version of him. but clearly that's the point. And when you talked about power dynamics, whoever has the chair at any one time ultimately has the power. It doesn't matter what sort of character they are, how strong they are in real life, how aggressive their interventions are, if they have the chair, they are in charge. And when they say shut up, people shut up. And if they say no arguing in the corridor, come back in, then the very strong characters who are all arguing in the corridor file back in, heads down, and get back on with it. And that was very arresting.
This is also something that is reflected in the particular group of people that Campido decides to focus on as his main characters, because it is obviously undeniable that AIDS and HIV activism was something that was primarily coming from the gay men's community. However, I think it's fantastic that Campido has decided to look beyond just a simple gay men's health kind of group, which is where all of this stem from, and include so many other examples of people who were affected by this. So there are quite a few female characters who are very, they're sketched, but they are sketched very thoroughly and very interestingly, and I found them, the two of them, really compelling.
Yeah.
One of my favorite characters is Helene.
I was, the mother and son. The mother. Who are real, based on real people that were in the group with Robin.
The situation there is the son is a teenager who has picked up HIV from blood transfusion. He's a hemophiliac, and whenever they go into actions and things like that, the group really looks after him, making sure that he has his medication. When the police drag him away, they pick up his pills and just take him with them, and they shout to the police, he's hemophiliac, please look after him. Because hemophilia is an illness through which if you get a cut or something and you start bleeding, you will just continue to bleed to death. There's this kind of caring nature of it. There is also a character who I think is a prostitute, a character who's a drug addict, and a character who's deaf and comes in with his interpreter, who then signs. And that's another great moment when you're sort of in silence watching this person speak, and then the interpreter translates for the rest of the group.
Yeah.
And I thought really the democracy and the diversification of this group was so organic and very, very accurate and very reflective of so many different aspects of this big question. So it was amazing, because I think this gives the film a lot of relatable points.
Yeah, and you mentioned there about how important this group dynamic and the relationships between them is. And I loved it how, you know, these are people that are, they're closer than brothers and sisters. They're closer than a family. They are. They're each other's lovers. They're each other's doctors. They're each other's advisors. They're all scientists. They're all politicians. They're all writers. They have to be so many things for each other.
Yeah.
And that really comes across.
And of course, none of them are that by business.
Yeah, exactly.
They're all people who do other things. One of them is a hospital porter. Another is a graphic designer or something like that. And these were all people who were forced into, you know, medical research, into having to analyze and understand very detailed and complex chemical reports, who learned to medicate themselves and others and help each other. And this is really the great, astonishing result.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
So the group, act up. I don't know if you guys are familiar with the documentary How to Survive a Plague, which is the history of the New York group of ACT UP. And
was that the original? Was that where it started?
Yes. Yeah. So ACT UP started in New York, I think in 1987, as a result of the Gay Men's Health Center, I think it was called, which was the very, very first group of gay men's activists against AIDS. And that kind of group collapsed for various reasons. And one of their members was Larry Kramer, the playwright who wrote The Normal Heart, which is considered to be the first AIDS play. 1987, and it was really a personal story, much like BPM, of his engagement with this particular group. And it's really the story of a bunch of men dying and kind of really trying to help each other. Mm. And one thing that always struck me about that film and that play, which was turned into a film by HBO, is just how many funerals there are. Mm. They're constantly going to funerals. And there's a character who has an address book of contacts and is pulling out a leaf from it every day. So there's a sense of, you know, dispersing and losing people on a daily basis. I mean, the AIDS virus was a plague. Mm. Millions of people died in the first 10 years of it. I think as of today, there are 36 million people who are affected by it. So right at the time of the Gay Men's Health Center sort of falling apart and disbanding, Larry Kramer attended another activist meeting and said, we need to do something that is actual political action. This cannot be treated simply as a medical issue, but it's an issue that requires the intervention of governmental policy. And of course, this was Reagan's America. Mm. No one was interested in helping a group of gay men to survive. In fact, from my memories, there was a lot of sort of complacent thinking that they've brought this upon themselves, unfortunately, and the church was vastly complicit in this.
It's worth mentioning, actually, that what you've just described about Reagan's America is not a million miles away from Mitterrand's France either. I think that comes out a little bit in the film. It's not quite as overbearing as how you're describing, but you know, France has often puffed its chest out and boasted about liberty, equality, and fraternity. Around this time, there was precious little of any of those, especially as far as the minorities that are described in the film are concerned. And so we talk about Reagan's America. It was the same, frankly, in France. And there's a couple of little allusions in the film. One is a couple of a chap gets up in the tube and walks away, doesn't he, when he sees Arno and Nathan kissing. It was exactly the same problem. These people had done their homework, these young people, and they were simply trying to get the message across that gay people should not be treated differently because of their lifestyle. And something we assume and take for granted now was absolutely not taken for granted at the time, even in a country which is at the forefront of human rights.
Yeah, and in fact, I think I read Robin Campillo talk about precisely this and sort of discussing how even the notion and the idea of promoting liberty, equality and fraternity, obviously the big ideals of the French Republic, which had just had its big anniversary in 1989. Yes. So, you know, Bastille, this big anniversary, the French Revolution, obviously this great moment of people's activism and revolt against a system that's effectively oppressing and functioning on inequality. He was saying that the climate of, you know, pushing this message and this discourse of equality meant that minorities and minority issues were completely disregarded, that no one was really taking care of them. So that's, I think, another reason why the film's representation policy is so significant and so accurate and really functional, and it's very successful as well.
Worth mentioning that in terms of the political messages that the ACT UP were getting across, and what makes it works so well with BPM is that the characters themselves are in themselves slogans and banners. It's their own disease. It's their own bodies that are there on show. It's their own wasting away. And they personalize the political struggle so well and so strongly. And obviously that works really, really well in the film, because as you are connecting with characters, you're recognizing that the characters are trying to make themselves connect, or trying to make their situations and their personal lives and backgrounds and lifestyles connect with the public as well. And that's a sort of terrific recipe.
Yeah, I loved how they talk about what to do at the Gay Pride each time. I'm not sure how what sort of time span the film has.
It jumps by months. I've noticed cuts, in fact, overlapping sequences, right, which jump by months. I only noticed that last night when I watched it again. But I think we're talking about 2 or 3 years.
Okay. But yeah, each time when it's Gay Pride, they talk about what's the best. And the scene where they're coming up with different slogans is genuinely really funny.
Yes.
Some of them are impossible to translate and absolutely perfect.
But I think this is an interesting thing about the film, is, and I spoke to this about Robin a little bit, your expectations for a film with this subject matter, you know, a film about a disease that killed millions of people. You'd expect it to be very grave, very morose, very kind of depressing and downbeat. But this film is so lively and so wants to live. And I think that's reflected in those really heated debates they have in the boardroom, and then also in everything outside the boardroom. So should we talk a bit about what happens outside the boardroom? And before we start recording, you guys were talking about Paris in the film and how Paris is viewed.
Yeah, to me, it's kind of, I was having a thought that sort of connects both with what Julian was talking about and what you were talking about, the idea of the body personal made the body political, and how it connects with action and mm-hmm. taking to the streets and doing things that are, you know, clearly very exhilarating in terms of taking action, protesting, throwing fake blood bombs around, smashing things up, which they don't really do that much of, but there was a lot of that.
Yeah.
It wasn't a sort of violent protest, but stuff did get smashed. But also this idea of the street as this public place where yeah. you parade, enjoy a gay pride, and that conversation about the slogans for gay pride yeah. is also so funny.
Yeah.
The film has a lot of humor about everything, you know, and it's also very brilliant at showing the extravagance of so many of these characters. So Sean has this idea of doing the gay cheerleaders who are going to come up with all these slogans yeah. About AIDS and raising awareness of it. And it's hysterical. Mm. Plus, the music really helps. There's a lot of, moments when the groups go clubbing after the big action, yeah. the big sort of protest, the big political engagement moment. They'll go clubbing and they're all just kind
it's
of...
almost like a sort of ritual for them, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah, dancing around and jousting with each other and just kind of... It's very joyful. And yet, at the same time, there's a melancholy to it.
Yeah.
And something incredible happens in the first scene when they go clubbing.
That's right. Well, I suppose if you're leading me on to that, then that is the standout sequence. And this is, again, to come back to the way Campillo thinks about filmmaking now. He is determined to be truthful and realistic, if he can. But he will not allow himself to be stuck in one type of aesthetic. He's determined as well to go. He wants to explore the sensual side of cinema, and what he calls the dreamlike side of cinema. Mm. And you can see this best in the club scenes, which are shot with a completely different aesthetic and a very interesting conceit of showing the space between the dancers and showing essentially the atmosphere and the air. And what we see are dust particles reflected in a spotlight. And those dust particles then suddenly congeal to create what could look like a virus. And so it's the most sort of abstract and experimental part of the film. And yet it's done in such a simple way. And in fact, it was shot in a very simple way. They simply changed the focus and put a spotlight on the atmosphere in the nightclub. And the dust particles were there. Originally, he thought it would just be thin air. And the dust particles were there. And that got him to think about how it worked. But the point is, and it's coming back on what you said, Irina, which is that the shroud of death is always there. And what Campillo, he wants to make sure that we never completely let go of that. But what he does is to essentially reflect his own reality, which was that it was a joyful time. It was a very, very exciting time for him. As I said, he was a withdrawn young man who was caught up in something extremely exciting. And when you talked about comedy and performance, his obsession with acting is perfect for this, because all of these characters are actors. They're performers. They have to essentially carry out what we call stunts or whatever, and they have to perform. And there are essentially moments of genuine comedy. My own standout one is the one where they go into a school classroom and they interrupt the history lesson or something and ask the teacher for 10 minutes of her time so that they can talk about AIDS to her pupils, who are all sort of mid-teenagers. And, of course, she agrees because she thinks it's an important message. And then halfway through a discussion about lubricant and fellatio, she starts to realise that she might have gone a bit far. And just when you're already laughing at this point, and then just when you think it's... the comedy's over, the bell goes. These students had been transfixed up till then by these people coming in and talking about AIDS. And then the bell goes, the buzzer. And of course, like all students in every school ever, they all start packing away their stuff and leaving before he's finished talking.
So yeah.
It's a brilliant comedy sketch.
And and yet within that, you have these two moments. There is a boy who is looking very, very serious and very sad, and who is completely transfixed by the people he's looking at. There's a sense of recognition there. Yeah. Am I one of them? Am I at risk? Has he done something? As we hear time and time again in the film, Sean's backstory is that he gets infected the first time he has sex, and he has sex with his teacher at age 16. So in this boy, we see obviously a kind of echo, I think, especially watching the film the second time around. I hadn't noticed him so much the first time.
Is that scene before or after the when you find out about Sean?
I think it's after because Sean and Nathan kiss for the first time.
Yeah. We don't hear that boy speak, do we?
He doesn't speak. No, he just looks at them and he doesn't... I don't think he even picks up a condom. He just looks at them. Yeah. But there is something that the camera does lingering on him, which is extraordinary.
Yeah, and even later when they're in the courtyard of the school... He sort of slowly walks out of the door and it still focuses on him. Yeah. You're thinking, what's going on?
And of course, they also then talk to this girl who says, well, I don't need a condom. I'm not going to have, I'm not going to pick up AIDS because I'm not gay. And then, you know,
a wonderfully nonsensical thing to say.
Absolutely. Absolutely. But it sort of tells you what the mindset was at the time and what a lot of, in my experience as a girl growing up in Catholic Italy, we were certainly never encouraged to use condoms because, you know, God doesn't want you to use condoms. Obviously, God doesn't want you to have sex at all.
Abstention is the only
Obviously, that's a message that's never going to work out. No. So all of these stunts about distributing condoms and sort of talking to students at that young age, we're bringing home a reality that I think many parents were kind of really in denial about, and certainly the big political sphere was.
Julian, you lived in Paris in the 90s when this film
was
set?
Yes, well, briefly. Coincidentally, I was reading about when Robin Campillo joined ACT UP, and it was in 92, which is when I moved to Paris for 2 years. I was at university there for... I probably won't linger too long on this because I know you're going to ask me, did you get involved in all these things? I was actually vaguely aware of ACT UP Paris, but I think one of the striking things looking back is that the coverage of ACT UP Paris was relatively pathetic, actually. We heard about their activities in student circles, but they weren't on television. Mm. They weren't properly mediatized. And it always struck me that Robin Campillo rightly says that this is a film that tries to explain that we need militancy now more than ever. And this was real militancy. And what we have now is we have angry armchair critics using social media. It strikes me that he's obviously absolutely right about this. And I can't, I have to hold my hands up. I've never been particularly engaged like you, Irena. but social media, ironically, had it been around at the time of ACT UP Paris, then all of us would have known all about them, and they would have been much more prominent, and they would have had much less of a struggle to get their message across. And I think it's testament to the fact that they achieved what they did achieve without really any assistance from the French media at all.
ACT UP did get involved, ACT UP Paris specifically, did get involved in a very big mediatized stunt, which is referred to very briefly in the film. And it's someone says this idea jokingly, says, let's put a big pink condom on the obelisk in Place de la Concorde. And they did actually do it on the 1st of December 1993. It lasted about 20 minutes before it was taken down. But there are pictures if you look it up online. What's quite interesting is that this stunt became, there's sort of two things. One is, because it happened on the 1st of December, that's the reason why the 1st of December is World AIDS Day.
Oh, okay.
I think it's commemorated every year for that. And secondly, this was sponsored by United Colors of Benetton. They needed a sort of sponsor to kind of, first of all, make the giant giant condom. But also United Colors of Benetton was one of those brands that had a very... controversial ad creative whose name was Oliviero Toscani, who was also himself a photographer. And at the time, he was involved in making these campaigns, which had very shocking imagery. And some of them had, you know, the clothes of a soldier who was killed in Bosnia, so slightly later on. Some of them had images of a nun and priest kissing. And one of his campaigns that was incredibly shocking and incredibly controversial in Italy was using a colorized photograph of a dying AIDS activist whose name I think was David Kirby, who may have been... who was a, if he's the right person that I'm thinking of, he was a performance artist, and he his role was to play Jesus whenever they did protests against the church, and kind of I think you see him quite a lot in How to Survive a Plague, and in this particular advert, you know, photograph, he is represented in basically his final days, and he looks like you know a dying Christ from a Goya painting. His face is totally emaciated and his parents are around him kind of crying. Obviously, this was done to raise awareness of the AIDS crisis, but also to sell clothes, which was very despicable. But at the same time, in Italy, for instance, it did bring it into the conversation. Suddenly people knew what this was, which is not something that had happened before.
Yeah. The story of how you whether you compromise what you're doing is prominent as well in the film.
Yeah,
this is so much. It's two and a quarter hours film. There's so much in it. And yes, indeed, the debates often rage around. You know, do we? You know, to what extent? How far do we go? Who do we partner up with? You know, will we be seen as sort of selling out? So yeah, I'm not surprised what you say about the Benetton ad. I mean, the condom on the Obelix, which was actually on the mainstream news at 9 p.m. was that has everything of the stunt, and it would need the support of a corporation like that for something like that to get off the ground. I don't know how much it would have cost to paint the Seine red.
Such a great scene.
Somebody will rustle up some cash to do that.
Did they actually recreate it for the film? I wonder.
It's the idea of a red river and blood red river is sort of. From sort of ancient literature, but Campillo himself said that it was an idea that came up in one of the debates, but he said he liked the idea of a river anyway. He saw the River Seine as a kind of an emblem of his film because the way, again, I'm sorry to always drag it back to him and the way he thinks about films, but he said his film is like a river novel, a roman fleuve, which is a sort of, shall we say, a long, drawn-out story, but with lots of different tributaries and directions, but it always keeps moving in one direction. And that was that symbol.
And also the sense of flow, you know, the flow of life and the continuation and the blood flow. To me, the first time I saw the club scene in which, you know, you move from people clubbing and then the scene becomes more and more abstract as we've described it, the first time I was looking at it, I thought I was really watching the inside of someone's veins, the blood moving into it. And I think this connects back to the title of the film, which is, you know, the notion of 120 BPM, which is obviously the rhythm you dance to in club music, but also a heart that's working at an incredibly high, heightened, excited rate. And that's the excitement of life, of danger, of everything that can happen to you and how this just keeps pumping and going. I think it's probably worth going into a spoiler area now and talk about the closing sequence of the film.
Yes.
All right, yeah. So if you haven't seen the film, do go check it out and then quickly come back for this section. One of the main things that a lot of people say about the film after seeing it is they talk about how long they cried for.
Yes.
And you've already mentioned you cried for 120 minutes.
Yep.
Exactly.
Exactly.
Well, I won't disclose how long I cried for. It's probably in tears most of the film, on and off. Obviously, the final section involves the death of one of the main characters. And if you like, that is dealt with over a course of a good half hour, actually. And it's not, no punches are pulled there. Immediately afterwards, as I said before, there's this regrouping of the main characters that we've seen and a sense of continuation, but also a sense of celebration of the life of the character that's died. What strikes me about the whole film is that in 2.25 hours of a film chock to the brim with politics, what really comes out at the end is the sensuality of the piece. And sensuality, not in terms of naughty stuff, although there's sort of plenty of that if you're a fan, but in terms of the sense that feeling is what matters most to what Campillo wants. Mm. He wants, there is no sequence in 120 BPM, however dry, that is not punctuated with feeling. And I don't think that's an artificial construct. I think that represents Campillo's experience of living with these people. You could have a long debate and then somebody would faint because they were physically unwell. You could have sequences where people were arguing and shouting at each other and hurting each other's feelings, and then somebody would say something so ridiculous that they'd all start laughing. And that change in tone is there, and it's about saying all these things mattered. They're very, very important messages. The actual debate itself is the crucible of the drama, but it always comes back to emotion. It always comes back to feelings, and that's the sensuality that came through, I think.
Yeah, I mean, to me, what struck me about that final sequence is how much it came back to life. I started crying at the scenes where the sun is turned red. There were lots of moments that were really, really moving in the film up until that point. The funeral of Jeremy being one of them. He was, you know, the first one who has this kind of street parade funeral. But then that moment with the river, it just sort of got me. And I started to cry and cry and cry. And then eventually, a good 30 minutes later, we get to Sean's death, which is obviously devastating. And I thought the film was over. And then after that, we get this extraordinary quarter of an hour in which people start to arrive.
Yeah.
Sean's mother makes coffee. She's bought biscuits for people. A lot of coffee. You need it. And people hug each other and people cry and people say, I want to see the body. And people say, I don't want to see the body. And then there is this incredible shot, which I think is just the greatest and most revelatory shot in the film, in which you are looking at simultaneously two rooms in the flat. Yeah. And in one room is the dead body of Sean, who has been dressed mm-hmm. and is ready to be taken away. And in the other room is the group all together talking about what they're going to do next, yeah. talking with his mother. And there's incredible warmth there. And there is that moment of comedy yeah. in which they say to the mother, well, you're probably aware that Sean wanted to have a political funeral and wanted his ashes scattered onto the insurers who refused to insure him and look after him because he was sick. And the mother, this is no news to her, but she says, so were you thinking of a 50-50 arrangement? she says, I would like to keep some of them. So were you thinking of a 50-50 arrangement? She goes, I was thinking more of an 80-20 yeah. arrangement, you know. Yeah. It's still my child. But in the end, she does give some of his ashes away. And what you see next is the next action. What are they going to do? Yeah. And they do scatter his ashes onto this, like, insurer's conference party or yes. whatever. And they're having these yeah. canapes feast. And champagne. Oh, yeah. All, you know, smeared with his ashes. And then the music starts again. And then I just thought, by this point, I just couldn't see anymore because yeah. I was a mess.
You're taking it. It's fun. The going back to that one sequence that you isolated with the dead body in one room and the group in the other room just going on. That includes a hookup, doesn't it, between Sean's ex-boyfriend and Tibor, who had his eyes on him from the start. That, I think, that sequence where you split the two is, I think it's a taboo-breaking shot. Because I think the death is absolutely present in that scene, and there's no shying away from it. And the film has completely earned that shot, which is could be grotesque in a lot of different films if it wasn't earned in the way it was. Because death has always been there with them, alongside them, in everything they've done. And the way the film doesn't let you quite forget that, and then simply demonstrates it very clearly at the end is, as you say, that's the one that takes people over the edge quite often.
Yeah, absolutely.
Film of the year.
It's a bit early, isn't it?
Yeah.
Is it? I've been wanting to say it since October when I saw it. I think it'll be hard to, I think I'll find it hard to find another film this year that has the same impact on me.
Yes, it's a film that will stay with people for a long time.
I think so, definitely. Yeah. Well, we're talking about it and it's not been released yet in the UK, but already people have been talking about this for months. And that's partly because it's been, you know, it was premiered at Cannes last year. But yes. I think it really has a lasting impact that a lot of films don't have over a month.
Also worth mentioning that it was totally robbed of its Oscar that it completely deserved and was unfortunately not nominated for But that could be another podcast episode talking about the reasons why.
Yeah.
Possibly too much naughty stuff.
It's politics.
Yeah. Yeah. We haven't touched on the naughty stuff that much.
No.
But there is an incredible sex scene in this film, and it's really long, but really, really important. It feels really needed and necessary.
I think Campillo, Eastern Boys, he'd already started a little bit with showing, not graphic sex, but with showing sort of not hiding, you know, the obvious things one hides in sex scenes. He goes a little bit further this time, but I think what he really likes about sex scenes is the ancillary aspects of sex and the before and after, the discussions in this case about, you know, the ethics of a zero positive and a zero negative. I don't know if you know what the English expression is.
HIV positive
people having sex. Prosaic details of lube and contraceptives, etc. And little details. The conversation is almost more important. Maybe me saying this, but I think the conversation around that sex scene is almost more important than the sex aesthetically. Yeah. And the honesty of it is brilliant, because the honesty makes up for the fact that it's not a graphic pornographic sex scene, but it feels absolutely as if it were real.
Yeah, it's sex about intimacy.
Yeah.
And it's about these two people really discovering each other and telling each other the stories of past lovers as well, which are very likely ghost stories, both of their ex-partners or sort of the people they conjure up are likely dead. And so there's this kind of, again, the sense of something that is full of life happening at the same time as the memory of a very likely death, which is absolutely extraordinary and is what makes these sex scenes so functional to the film and so affecting.
Absolutely.
I thought you were going to mention the sex scene in the hospital, actually, which is a bit shorter. But when you at the London Film Festival, where Robin Campillo was there, somebody stood up and very sheepishly asked, "Why did you have him giving him a hand job in the hospital?" And then sat down again. And everyone sort of slightly groaned and eye-rolled and thought, this is not a very good question. But Robin Campillo, I think, answered, it took about 15 minutes to answer the question. It turned out to be one of the most fascinating questions to him. And I suspect it's probably because it's not one that he'd had been asked before.
Totally.
And he went into some detail, which I don't know how, you know, how much we can go into, but he said originally the sequence was supposed to end with a facial ejaculation.
Right.
But the actors, having discussed it, felt that it might be physically difficult to achieve that, largely because I think the actor playing Sean, Nahuel Biscayar, said that he wouldn't have the physical strength to do what was needed in order for that to happen. But Campillo also said that he is not interested in provoking, and whilst he believes in truth and honesty in sex scenes, he knows that the provocation is what would come out first if he had if he'd done a sequence like that, and he in the end he preferred what the actors had done. That is emblematic, I think, of the way he is as a filmmaker. As a writer and editor, he had no connection with actors. He simply wrote sequences for them and then cut them. As he became a filmmaker, he allowed himself to be taken over by actors and actors' reactions. And he said something very, 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 very interesting, which is that he sees himself as the main character in his film Eastern Boys, played by Olivier Rabourdin. He's a character who allows himself to be invaded in that film. And he says that that's how he feels when he's working with actors on a project. And he wants them to make the running. And then as they work, he sees the gestures, he sees their personalities. And essentially, he takes the script in that direction. Mm. It's not especially new and original, but what I think is fascinating about Campillo is it's the guy who worked as a writer and editor and then found himself as a director in a totally different register.
One quick thing I wanted to add about the hand job scene in the hospital is that it's also incredibly comedic. It's funny. There's aspects to it that are funny, much as a lot of sex is funny and weird, if you think about it. But it's also a great reminder to Sean that his body can do other things than just being a sick body.
Yeah.
And I think that is an incredibly compassionate gesture and the true gesture of a lover who can still see him as that body, as opposed to the body who's covered in sores and dying. And I that was like an incredible, incredible scene to me. I didn't find it
emotional,
silly,
again.
Emotional, yeah. And really very understandable and full of empathy and just very humane.
So that is BPM, Film of the Year, as we've
Film
decided.
Of the Year.
So that's out in cinemas and is also available on Curls on Home Cinema as well. And if you do have any thoughts on 120 beats per minute, do let us know by emailing podcast@curlson.com and we'll read them out on next week's show. Did you cry longer than Irena? The record is currently 120 minutes.
It may be poetic license.
You can cry for 6 months, haven't you?
So please do subscribe to the show and leave a comment and a review, and you can catch us on iTunes and Acast. Thank you both for chatting with me today.
Pleasure.
Thank you.
So thank you, Julian Allen, for
thank
making
you very
your
much.
Pod debut. Hope
thank
you enjoyed
you
it.
Very
and
much.
Thank you, Irena.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. See you next week.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.